outskirts of Minneapolis. It's That's the Thing, the film podcast where twin critics talk about, well, what else? Films. And it is another episode in our ongoing miniseries, Smells Like Twin Critics. I'm your co-host, Nick Cooey, and joined with me, as always, is Alex Cooey. Alex, how are you doing on this glorious spring day?
Hello, everybody. Happy spring. I'm doing just fine. Thank you for asking. It's been a lovely 21st of March today at this time of recording.
Yeah, it's a little overcast, but you know, I mean, it's warm and it's appropriately spring-like, I would say.
Yeah, it certainly does feel like spring is here. So that feels like a great relief. It's one of the small comforts I think we can take solace in.
Especially when you live in Minnesota. And
yeah.
Yeah, when it's par for the course, it's about 6 inches of snow on the ground this time of year. But no, it's a really nice day. It's a really nice day to just sit inside and talk about another movie from 1991. As I said earlier, this is the second episode in our Smells Like Twin Critics miniseries, where we look back on the year 1991 because it's 30 years ago now, and it was the year that we were both born. So we're just kind of taking a look back on the films from that year, the films that defined cinema for 1991. And this episode, this week, we were thinking of pivoting away a little bit from the commercial fare of something like Beauty and the Beast into maybe something less commercial, but I would argue not as inaccessible as one might think. And that's Edward Yang's A Brighter Summer Day. And, I mean, I have to be honest, Alex, I was, you know, when we were thinking about this miniseries, this is the one title I remember telling you, like, you know, if we have to do a film from 1991 that I, you know, wouldn't want to veto, it would be this one.
Yeah, I remember you being very adamant about this film. And even before we were thinking about doing a 1991 retrospective, you had been speaking very highly about this movie for quite some time. And so I was glad I finally got around to seeing it, because it's not that I didn't want to see it, but I'm sure, like some of you listeners might think, you know, I was a little daunted at the fact that it was a 4-hour period piece with over 100 speaking parts in it.
And, you know, we did think to ourselves, you know, because as Alex said, it's March 21st, since the Snyder Cut of Justice League came out, we thought, why not talk about a different 4-hour movie?
A different 4-hour film that was hard to find for lots of fans, and so they've been clamoring for it for years until finally they got what they wanted.
I mean, and, well, you know, we can talk about, like, what we think about it, or, you know, the critical reception around it afterwards. I think it might be a little different from Justice League, but I will say that, like, you're right, Alex, that the film was, I mean, one of the big reasons, another reason why I'm sure you didn't see it was because it was so hard to actually watch for most of our lifetime. I mean, for the better part of a quarter of a century, this A Brighter Summer Day was kind of, it had accrued a reputation as one of the most well-praised yet difficult to see films in world cinema, in contemporary world cinema. I mean, it had no theatrical release in the United States. I know that it's outside of its native Taiwan, it did receive a limited theatrical showing in the ICA in London in March of 1993. I'm not sure about other international markets, but definitely like the United States, the only kind of screenings that it has received has been at repertory screenings in kind of about a decade ago. And even then, it took another 5 years until 2016 for the film to get a home video release of any kind. Thankfully, it was the 4K restoration undertaken by the World Cinema Project, and it was released by the Criterion Collection. It's got a whole treasure trove of extras, which I think actually are really helpful in contextualizing the film, because as you were saying as well, Alex, this is a dense movie.
Oh yes, it's a very complex film, and especially if you're, I mean, it's interesting how some people say, like, you know, a contemporary Taiwanese audience would need some context too for going into the film, but I imagine, like, if you're especially a Western audience that has no understanding or idea about Taiwanese history, I think even though there's like a little title card at the beginning of the film that explains some context, I think that there would still need to be a bit more explanation before you get into it.
Yeah, so we should get into 1947, because two significant things happened that year. One is that Edward Yang was born later on in the year, in November, I believe. And the second significant thing was the 228 massacre, which did happen on February the 28th, 1947. And on that day, that was when several thousand protesters who were just protesting the Republic of China's government, which was led by the Chinese nationalist government, the Kuomintang, or KMT. The KMT cracked down on these protesters and killed thousands, literally thousands of people. I think an exact number hasn't been determined, but this act essentially paved the way for what would become about 40 years almost of martial law on the island, beginning in 1949, and it lasted until 1987. And Edward Yang's family moved from Shanghai to Taiwan following the Chinese Civil War, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that's right. In which the Chinese Civil War was it was a conflict between the Kuomintang and the communist-led factions, which were led by Mao Zedong.
Right.
And so after the Kuomintang was defeated, they fled to the island nation of Taiwan and set up a military government there. And yes, as you were alluding to, so then they basically let control the government for like 40 years. And it was sort of a quasi-military state. And during certain periods of decades, particularly in the mid-1960s, there, you know, they did to have a bit of like more oppressive crackdown tactics on trying to like find any possible communist sympathizers or people who maybe are connected with sympathizers. And this became known as a period known as the White Terror.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. It was, yeah, essentially a crackdown on perceived dissidents of the government who were, of course, yeah, perceived as threats to the KMT and its leader, Chiang Kai-shek. I mean, of course, how many of those people actually were threats and how many weren't is completely a matter of debate. But it was an incredibly traumatic period for Taiwan's history. And at the same time, and the thing is, like, we're bringing this up because not only is the 1960s the milieu for A Brighter Summer Day, and it informs the backdrop of the film, but it was also the backdrop of Edward Yang's youth growing up in Taipei. And it's, and I mean, and Edward Yang talked a lot about kind of his experiences growing up. I mean, there's this really interesting interview where he was talking a lot about, it was with the New Left Review, where he's talking about kind of growing up and his own sort of view of authority. And he said something really interesting. He said, quote, "For any urban youngster, the atmosphere of the society was very oppressive. You didn't have to have any particular political ideas to feel this. It was all around you. Rules and regulations, attitudes and institutions were authoritarian at every level, from school upwards. No one could risk openly defying this, at a time when just sporting the wrong length of hair could get you into trouble. So in my generation, the typical phenomenon was outward conformity and inner rage. We were told all these lies by the government and had no trust in it. Our parents didn't trust it either."
Mm. And, you know, I find that interesting that you pull up that quote, because I think that really informs a lot about the tone and the material that that presents itself with the film A Brighter Summer Day. Mm-hmm. And what's also to give a context too, because we did kind of allude to this too in our retrospective episode of Yi, but like we also talked about how A Brighter Summer Day sort of came about because of the New Taiwan Cinema Movement, which occurred in the early 1980s and lasted until the early 1990s. And to give some context on that, basically, the Taiwanese cinema was kind of an industry which was relatively newish for the nation. Like, they really didn't start until maybe the 1950s or so.
Right. And much of the cinema that had been around in the 50s and the 60s through the 70s was very much primarily government-sanctioned propaganda films, kind of promoting this agrarian utopic lifestyle. And for his part, Edward Yang, when he was growing up, a lot of the films that he was watching weren't Taiwanese films. They were imports. They were cultural imports from other countries, particularly the West. And that was partially because of the relationship that Taiwan had with the United States and with other countries. So you would get like this really interesting, I mean, he would be talking about like watching Bresson and Fellini films in their first run when they first came out.
Mm, yeah. And I can imagine them having quite an influence on him in his formative years. But yeah, it wasn't until after the 70s, because then the box office returns for those kinds of movies that were being made by the Central Motion Picture Corporation, I believe it's called, or the CMPC for short, which was formed in 1954 as a merger between the Taiwan Motion Picture Corporation and the Agricultural Education Motion Picture Company. They had been struggling, and it was like the only major like film company in Taiwan, but they had been struggling to make box office hits because people wouldn't go see those kinds of movies that were being made now. So they decided to try to experiment a little bit, get some newcomer directors to try to bring something new to the table. And so then there was a film released in the early 80s called In Our Time, which was an anthology film that was directed by a lot of newcomers, including Edward Yang.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right. And the thing is, I think what's also important to note is that Edward Yang, along with some of the other major figures of the new Taiwan cinema, including, of course, Ho Sha-shen, originally came from television. And one of the big factors that led to kind of this fledgling industry was also the fact that Taiwan itself was going through something of a crisis, because in 1979, the United States, under Jimmy Carter, officially recognized the People's Republic of China, and they as an ally, and they no longer provided some of the they rescinded some of the offer for military aid for Taiwan should the People's Republic of China ever attempt to intervene or invade the country. And the country was also experiencing a great growing deal of industrialization, and that was something that impacted primarily the middle class. And that was something that Edward Yang in particular, I mean, not just Edward Yang, but Edward Yang would explore in some of his features, particularly his second and third films, Taipei Story and The Terrorizers.
Mm. Yeah. And also, the Taiwan cinema movement also became, it served as kind of an opportunity to lend a new kind of voice of representation that wasn't really seen in Taiwanese cinema previously. Like, for instance, the figures in the Taiwanese films would typically speak Mandarin Chinese, but under the new Taiwan cinema movement, they actually spoke Taiwanese, which was kind of a first. Mm-hmm. And I believe we kind of alluded to too in the Yi episode, there were some movies that were made that would focus on like basically the working class and middle class life, kind of like Italian neorealism films. But then there were others that would also focus on real-life historical traumatic events which weren't really discussed about previously, like in Ho Sha-shen's City of Sadness.
Right, and City of Sadness, I mean, it's definitely an important film, and arguably the pinnacle of the new Taiwan cinema, because it had its world premiere on September 4th, 1989, at the Venice Film Festival, and it was the first film to expressly and directly address the legacy of the White Terror and of the military dictatorship, which had ended only 2 years prior. And it was actually about the February 28th massacre. And so with that film, Edward Yang, you know, either consciously or subconsciously, sought to respond to that with his fourth feature film, which is A Brighter Summer Day. And that's where we can kind of get into a little bit of the plot, I guess, but How do you even approach the plot of this movie? Because it is like on its core level, it's a teen gang crime movie, and yet it is not because this is something that we have, of course, like post on the site about little spoilers as well. And this is something that we actually debated a little bit to talk about. But like the film was inspired by a real life murder. A real-life juvenile murder which occurred in the 1960s, and it was something that left a huge impression on Yang and several other members of his generation. And he sought to make a film that didn't really explore like the true crime, but it did use that as a springboard to think about what could be some of the factors which led to this crime occurring. And if I'm getting that wrong, I believe that's...
No, I think you're right. I was just going to add, like, and what was interesting, too, because he remembered when this crime happened, not just himself, but, you know, he also spoke with, like, colleagues and friends or people of his generation, and the interesting fact is that all those people in his generation, they remembered when that happened, this incident, but their parents or the previous generation, those people completely forgot about it. So it was, like, almost like... it was like, you know, it seemed like almost an example of like the Kuomintang, because it was a scandalous incident. It's like the Kuomintang wanted to kind of sweep it under the rug and to wipe it away from history, just like other dark chapters during their regime.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so Edward Yang undertook this project, which he, initially, and for quite a while, still believed would only end up being a 2.5 hour movie at most. And it did sort of begin as just sort of a film about two different gangs. And that is sort of what the film is about. It's about these two gangs, the Little Park Gang and the 217 Gang. And caught in the middle of this whole gang warfare is a young adolescent boy whose name is actually Zhang Zhen, who actually shares the same name as the actor who plays him, Zhang Zhen, who we have also spoken about a little bit from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And this was, as we noted in that episode, this was his breakthrough feature. And what's interesting is that the film is still ostensibly about this young boy who's nicknamed also Zhao Sir, and his family, who, much like Edward Yang's family, fled from Shanghai to Taiwan following the Civil War. And it's very much about this young boy's struggles of both growing up with adolescence and developing feelings for girls, particularly a young girl named Ming, and being torn between these notions of principle and honor and a sense of disillusionment and alienation, which becomes sort of much more prevalent as the film goes on. And that's a very simplified summary of the film, because again, like we've been saying, this is a film with a huge cast.
Yeah, and it is quite an ensemble piece. Even though Zhao Sir is the main character, there are other important figures too who kind of are connected to the events that happen with him, or they affect the trajectory that his journey goes on, like whether it's with his family, particularly his father, who actually is played by Chang Chen's real-life father.
Yeah, who was a professional actor as well. And it's also important to note that, again, not only was this Chang Chen's first movie, but a lot of the cast, a lot of the young cast of adolescents, this was their first movie, and a lot of the people who were working on the crew, this was their first movie too.
Yeah, exactly. So there was a lot of that enthusiasm, which Yang really thought would help him get through this, because this was also kind of a project that when he initially was making it, he actually wanted to make it completely independent of the CMPC. Even though, of course, as you were alluding to, he initially assumed it was going to be a 2.5 hour film, until he realized as he was developing the film and the characters, and as it went further along, the production budget and the run length time ballooned, until he eventually had to get funds from the CMPC eventually, along with some funding from the Japanese.
Right, right. And so then he had actually, if I remember correctly, he was preparing with his actors for the better part of a year in rehearsal. They shot the film in 6 months, and of course, from what I understand, there were some, you know, it was not necessarily easy because, again, because there was a lot of people who worked on this film for the first time. The film has 4 cinematographers credited in the film, and several of them, this is their first feature. Sometimes there would be these fears about kind of technical hiccups in terms of the image being underexposed. But I will say, like, from what I understand about the shoot is that the film, you know, that Edward Yang got the film finished as he saw to complete it. And, but of course he realized too that, the film in its final cut, his director's cut was just 4 minutes shy of 4 hours. And so he recut the film for more commercial distribution into a 3-hour cut. And that was a cut that was probably most available as this sort of rip of a laser disc with burned in subtitles that had been kind of circulating on the internet for the better part of the last 30 years. And I mean, it was kind of the one that I had first heard of when I first heard of this movie about a decade ago. And I didn't want to seek it out because I wanted to see the director's cut, and I did not want to see something that looked like crap and had these subtitles burned into the image.
No. And it's interesting that, you know, yeah, there was a 3-hour cut of the film, and there was also even a 2-hour cut of this film, which, I don't know, that feels like, it's very hard for me to grasp and fathom. We were also talking about this as we were prepping, and like, it was this thing where we ask each other, like, what will we cut out? And we're like, well, there's some things you could arguably cut out, but then it's like, as from what I've heard, even in the commentary with Tony Raines on the Criterion edition, you know, it's like it doesn't make some plot points as clear as it would in the director's cut. And I find it interesting that it was struggling, you know, it was kind of out of circulation for a long time, or at least was not very accessible to Western audiences, considering that Taiwan did submit this film as its representation for Best Foreign Film for that year.
At the Oscars, yeah. Yeah, which, and then it wasn't accepted. And the one thing I do know about the three-hour cut of the film is that it largely omitted the subplot involving Zhao Sir's father, who is a civil servant, we should add. And the distinction as well with the two gangs that are fighting, the little park boys, or the little park gang is generally sons of civil servants. The 217 gang is comprised primarily of boys whose fathers are more soldiers. And Zhao Sir's father, who's a civil servant, he ends up around, at a certain point in the film, becoming a target of the nationalist government and the target of persecution. And that's where the elements of the White Terror begin to sort of seep into the film and imbue more of this political context for the film. And the fact that that was completely absent in the commercial cut, for me, that's, while one may argue it doesn't directly affect the teen narrative, for me, it's inconceivable.
Yeah, I'm shocked hearing this, as that now that you're telling me, but you know, this was the first time for me watching this movie, you know, as we were prepping to do this episode. And you've seen this film like back when it first was released on a Blu-ray through Criterion, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the first time I watched it, yeah, it was over a long weekend, and yeah, I just kind of split it up into two parts, thankfully, which was kind of on the DVD that I brought from the library, and I watched it again a couple years ago when I was in grad school, and I actually had a chance to introduce the film for the screening, which was a real treat, and it was a good challenge for me to kind of brush up again on some aspects of Edward Yang's background and the film itself, and trying to give this something of a compact description of it and its plot, because there's a lot of thematic undercurrents in terms of loyalty, integrity, betrayal, and conformity, as I was kind of talking about earlier. And I think we're going to get into some of those as we approach the second half of the episode. For the time being, though, here's a commercial break.
Yes, I love you.
I always love you so. Why? Because you love me.
Because you love me. We found a perfect love. That's a love that's yours and mine. I love you and you love me. Dear, forever.
So we're getting back here to talk about kind of the film itself, and again, like I think, like, if we're gonna talk a little bit about A Brighter Summer Day, I think we've talked a little bit about the plot. Maybe we should talk a little bit about the form of the film, because what's interesting for me, you know, now watching it again with you this time, it's after I've watched a couple more of Edward Yang's movies, including Terrorizers, which I've kind of talked about this on this podcast before, and it's a film that I think is really great. But it's really interesting comparing Terrorizers to A Brighter Summer Day, because Terrorizers, and it's something that Frederick Jameson wrote a lot about, it feels a lot like a postmodern novel. But A Brighter Summer Day, it feels much more like, not a regression, but hearkening to an earlier literary form.
Yeah, I was going to say, it kind of, A Brighter Summer Day feels, watching it for the first time, it for me felt like a classical rich novel.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that the film actually explicitly evokes when Ming's boyfriend, Honey, who is the old leader of the little park gang, he comes out of hiding to return to Taipei, and he kind of gets involved with these complex negotiations with between the two gangs, and at one point he cites that in his travels during hiding, he was actually reading Tolstoy's War and Peace. And there's actually a really interesting... I haven't read, actually, War and Peace. I don't know about you. I mean, I've read a couple of things by Tolstoy, you know, but more of the short stories, not something like that thick.
No, neither have I.
But I will say, like, I was actually reading a couple of things about War and Peace, and there was actually something interesting. The second part, I believe, the epilogue of the second part, there's this passage where he writes, that Tolstoy writes, that I thought really is applicable to this film. He writes, so long as histories are written of separate individuals, and then I'm paraphrasing here, and not the histories of all, absolutely all those who take part in an event, it is quite impossible to describe the movement of humanity without the conception of a force compelling men to direct their activity toward a certain end. And the only such conception known to historians is that of power. And so, I mean, what do you make of that in terms of its own relation to the film and the way that it positions individuals, even though it is, as we've been talking about, Jaussure's story, but it's also very much focused on a lot of individuals, like his older brother getting involved with these gambling debts in a pool hall, with Ming and her relationship, with some of the other boys, with the father. I mean, what do you make of that?
Yeah, no, I was going to say I completely agree, because how, and that's I think actually one of the many, many great strengths of this film, is that how it paints these very detailed portraits of these individuals, but also shows how they become like part of a these collective movements, you know, as whether it's in these gangs, you know, like these teenage gangs, or whether there may be more adult gangs too, like with, for example, there's even a scene where Zhaoshu's father is speaking with an old friend and colleague, Mr. Wang, who, you know, even he kind of says the line, you know, like, hey, you know, we go back, you know, we're all friends, we're like a gang. So, and I like how Yang makes those connections and shows how, you know, even people who may feel so complex, it's like we feel like we do get to know them, like truly do, and yet they still become like just a piece of like a greater whole.
Well, and that's no accident. I mean, didn't Yang write biographies for each character?
Yeah, and I mean, this amazes me. Like, again, considering this is over 100 speaking parts, but apparently for the actors, he had written like these detailed biographies for all the characters, like their backgrounds, where they came from, and like even during the periods of the film, and he even wrote like what happens to them beyond the events of what's depicted in the film. Even if very little of what he wrote about them does appear in the final cut.
Yeah. And I mean, and it's interesting, you know, I'm thinking about like, you know, when you think about like a film that's like a 4-hour epic that, you know, something that balloons out of proportion and it goes kind of over budget. And it's not that this film is a flop. Actually, it was, weirdly enough, Yang's most commercially successful film in Taiwan. I mean, it still wasn't a big hit, but it was, you know, more successful than some of his other films. But you know, I think that there's something where you'd think like that this could, has the potential to sound like the Taiwanese Heaven's Gate, a film which I know has like undergone something of a critical reappraisal, but I don't think you and I are necessarily the biggest fans of that movie.
No, I mean, we're not the biggest haters either, but I think the key difference between this and Heaven's Gate, I think where this works wherein Heaven's Gate failed was that I think, again, all the characters and the environment, it all feels fully fleshed out and realized so that we are inhabiting this world. Whereas with Heaven's Gate, you know, like maybe some of the major characters in that, but like everyone else just feels kind of like props, you know, or just plot points, plot figures to, you know, just spout maybe exposition or just to be there to be victimized or something.
Or to service these, yeah, kind of thematic bookends, or not bookends, but just like little placeholders, I should say.
Yeah, and there is a lot of like, there's certainly a lot of thematic reoccurrence throughout the film, and that's one of the fascinating things for me watching this film, is seeing all the sort of echoes that occur throughout the film, and all the parallels and similarities that one can pick up and notice. Whether, like even, for example, like how, when you said that they essentially cut out the scenes with the father, you know, being interrogated and questioned, that just kind of astounds me to think, because of how, what was interesting for me watching as I was studying and looking at the film was how actually in many ways I feel that his character arc shares a lot of similarities with Zhao Sur's character arc too, about these two figures who kind of like, you know, try to maintain a sense of like maybe individuality and like maybe integrity, a code of honor, what have you, but then how they find themselves very much personally compromised, and then towards the end, like they're very much lost individuals, as you can tell by the film's tragic conclusion.
I mean, yes, it's absolutely tragic, and the thing is though is that Yang consistently weaves, as you were saying, he weaves throughout the film these thematic echoes and undercurrents that compound and expound upon his fundamental concerns with this social order that that promotes conformity. You know, I mean, there's a particular scene where a character named Kat, who is a friend of Zhao Sur's, who has a penchant for singing falsetto along with some other teenage boys, and he wants to become kind of the Taiwanese Elvis.
Yeah, they sing like at the Park Gang Boys, the little Park Boys, like this little place they have. It's almost like an ice cream parlor. It's where they have shows, and like their substitute leader, which is Honey's younger brother Deuce, he also sings, and he's very much obviously prefers to be a singer than a leader. And so, like, Kat sings with them, and then Kat has this. There's a little subplot involving him where he has this goal where he's inspired to want to become basically the Taiwanese equivalent of Elvis. And because his name's Kat, and because one of the nicknames for Elvis Presley was him as King Kat, so here
he's the heir apparent.
Exactly, you know, little Kat becomes the next King Kat.
Well, and the thing that's also interesting about that is that then he records a cover of "Are You Lonesome Tonight," which then leads into the English titles, the English title of the film, "A Brighter Summer Day," and kind of did that kind of why it's called that in terms of the characters questioning, is it pronounced "A Bright Summer Day" or "A Brighter Summer Day"? And that gets into, well, I'll get to that, what that leads into the other dominant theme of the film in a moment. But I just wanted to say about Kat, there's a scene where he's in a classroom and, the teacher is talking a lot about these particular characters, to pronounce them, just Chinese characters and how to pronounce them. And Kat asks how to pronounce "I," and the teacher then reprimands him by having to write it over and over again. And so there are examples like this throughout the film where you see these characters being punished for attempting to sort of not completely become subsumed within this homogenous, militaristic social schema. And the other thing that I wanted to just talk about in terms of the film's major theme is just that, again, that the sense of clarity. Because, other critics have written about this as well, about the film, but there's this motif of visibility, of light and darkness. And it comes in at the very beginning of the film with the logo of Edward Yang's production company, Yang and His Gang, where somebody's turning on a light bulb, and a flashlight becomes a very critical tool in the plot of the film.
Even Zhao Sur, in his little private room, which is like, I think, in the closet, you know, he likes to turn the lights on and off because he's having some trouble with his eyes.
Yes, his eyesight is failing. And that, yes, that does, it's a seemingly innocuous detail, but it ends up becoming a very critical component in the plot in the second half of the film.
And I think also very core to the nature of his character, too. I think it's very reflective of kind of his inability to kind of distinguish and see the truth of matters, like what he sees himself as in terms of like maybe his relationship with Ming and how she sees him in relation to her.
Right. And Yang reinforces this throughout the film in some extremely striking ways. And there are two examples I can think of. There's one shot I think it's such a wonderful little moment, but it's so simple, where there's a brief conversation between Zhao Sur and Ming on a staircase in the school. And any other director would have followed the characters talking on the staircase. But Yang does something different. He tracks back and he tilts the camera to the right. So what you see then are the two characters, the two young people talking, but in the reflection of this wooden door.
Yeah, and it's like a small, very blurry kind of. So you just get distinguished outlines.
Right. It's a really striking shot.
Oh, yeah, absolutely is. And I also think of another scene which involves darkness, and it's like one of the grander set pieces. It occurs around the middle of the film. I won't give away what it is, but like basically it's a sequence that occurs during this typhoon. and involves like a clash and like the lights going out at this place.
It's primarily the only lighting source of lighting is a flashlight, mm-hmm. in it, and
or candles even.
Yes, exactly. And it, I mean, and that was, I was going to say that was my second example, because there is particularly, there's a master shot, and it's one of many shots in this film that is a long take. And actually, David Bordwell, ever the assiduous film scholar, counted the film's shots. This film has about 520 shots. They last about, on average, 28 seconds. But, of course, they last for longer than that. And there's a shot at the end of the sequence that lasts for several minutes. And the only source of light is a flashlight. And for me, just like on a technical level, in terms of the marriage of like simplicity of form with the emotional undercurrent and just thematic gravity of the sequence of the shot itself. I mean, it's such a powerful moment in the film.
Oh yeah, it's truly an unforgettable sequence. I agree. And you know what I wanted to talk about too with the film is like, you know, one of the things you're talking about, you know, it's interesting too thinking about the theme of what I got from it was about identity. You know, which is occurs with all the characters, not just Yalcha and his father, but like, or even Kat. But then you have other characters too, who I think are struggling to come to terms with the sense of identity. Whether it's like maybe they're trying to, maybe betray or kind of like manipulate, smooth talk their ways. So you know, with gangs, or if they're people who come in, like for example, there's the character of Ma, who is like an exchange student. He has a story behind him where it's like, oh, apparently he killed this guy in a previous school. And he seems like, oh, cool, tough stuff. And he kind of...
And he's the son of a general, too. So he comes from a very affluent family.
Yeah, he even owns a samurai sword.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing, too. I mean, you know, yeah, he owns several weapons at his home. And it is kind of this interesting fusion as well of like, you see like Japanese accoutrements that have been left over from the 50 years of rule that Japan had, you know, with the island.
But, you know, and what's interesting is that even though he seems all cool and he bonds with Jaussure, but by the end of the film, he kind of, he ends up, you know, when you take out all, like, his background and things, he actually, you know, and as he comes to terms with himself, I think he kind of is like this hollow shell of a person by the end. I think is very devastating. But, you know, when I think about one of the characters, when listening to Tony Raine's commentary, there was an interesting critique he made, and he loved the film, but one of the characters he had a problem with was the character of Ming and her characterization, where I think he felt it didn't quite necessarily, the concept of her didn't quite necessarily jive with the film, where she is a character who we do know about her. Like, for example, she kind of moves from place to place with her mother who suffers from asthma. And she kind of is always in different relationships with these different boys, even though her heart's loyal to Honey. But she also kind of keeps herself emotionally distant from others. And Raines felt that was a conceptual problem. Even apparently the actress who played her was struggling with coming to terms with her character's motivations. And I wanted to ask you, Nick, do you find the character of Ming to be a shortcoming of this film?
I mean, I think that's a really great question, Alex. And it's something that a lot of critics have brought up when talking about the film in terms of Ming's opaque nature in relation to the other boys, you know. And that is sort of, it's a very fine line because, I mean, what the film is trying to do is like, by design, she is opaque. And there is this sense that that she's kind of this object of fascination and desire for a lot of the teenage boys, and they, you know, they talk frankly about like, oh, you know, Honey's not in town, you know, this other kid named Tiger, he's maybe on the sly with her, and yeah, I mean, it's, you know, she's the subject of gossip, and she's kind of idealized, and I think that, you know, Lisa Yang, who's the actress who plays her, I think she does a good job of trying to make Ming not feel like just simply this fetish object, while at the same time she's kind of understanding that because that's how she's viewed, that she's trying to sort of weaponize that and sort of gain a sense of agency because we see that she doesn't have any sort of social affluence. Her mother is chronically ill.
And she doesn't even have a father at the start. I mean, it's kind of alluded to that maybe her father was a military man and that he possibly was killed in service.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think though it's, I mean, for me, I don't think Ming as a character, I don't think that she ends up derailing the film in any sense, because I think the film is primarily through Zsasz's perspective, and I think because that is kind of the ground rules that Edward Yang is setting for himself, like, she is, again, opaque by design, but at the same time, I don't think that the film is... But she's, at the same time, she's somebody who's... I think she's like a lot of the young people in this film. She's not fully formed yet. I think she's somebody who's in the process of discovering who she is. And I think the tragedy of that underscores A Brighter Summer Day is that a lot of these young kids are trying to discover who they are when they're living within a society that is telling them, that's completely irrelevant. You have to just be this. And if you're not that, then you are expendable.
Yeah, I agree with you. Absolutely. And yeah, that's one of the core powerful components of the film. You know, I also, just thinking about it too, like, what I found interesting too about the film is the kind of blend, and also with identity, you know, this applies to identity, but I think also applies to many things. Like, I think the way that the film is kind of this mixture of, like, Western and Eastern culture, because it's not just the fact that you have these kids who are very much inspired by what's popular in Western culture at the time, like Elvis or this or that. But then also, I think how you have these tropes or stories that maybe you could apply to works of not just Eastern tales, but also Western filmmakers like Nicholas Ray with Rebel Without a Cause. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like Rebel Without a Cause, what it reminded me of was, like, how, you know, the kids are just like these struggling individuals who are just trying to come to terms with themselves, and they're frustrated. And the adult figures are at best inept and, you know, incompetent at helping them. And at worst, they're domineering and condescending.
And completely dismissive of their emotions as well. I mean, I'm really fascinated by, I think what makes the film so interesting in its presentation of Western iconography is that it's I think it's actually really complex, you know, and I think that because Edward Yang would talk a lot about, like, the use of rock and roll as a fixture within his youth actually was a very liberating component for his generation, and they felt like they could utilize rock and roll to actually be provocative against the nationalist government. But at the same time, of course, the reason that the nationalist government didn't do anything about it was because the United States was a close ally with Taiwan. And so, of course, the United States is profiting off of this sort of partnership. And we even see that, these are kids who are listening to music by the Fleetwoods, and they're going to see Rio Bravo and watching John Wayne Westerns. And there's even this really interesting moment where Zsasz is very much acting kind of in a... He dons a hat and is, of course, emulating this cowboy figure, you know?
Yeah, he's got the John Wayne swagger down.
Exactly, he's got the John Wayne swagger down. But what that does is that it also kind of prefigures a little bit of this... It has this undercurrent of violent menace as well. And I think and that's something I think is also just wonderful about Yang. Even though he doesn't have any... All of the music in the film is non-diegetic, and even though the pacing, one could say, is a little slow... I think he's a real master in terms of the slow burn, that the film just gradually becomes quietly more and more tense, particularly as Zsasz himself becomes almost completely cut out of the film, even when he's an actual character in the film.
Yeah, I was going to say, it is interesting too, like the way that also showing that sense of isolation, how that's reflected in the mise-en-scene, the way that Yang determines who gets to be cut out of the frame and who gets to be in the frame, and how it can really reflect that sense of isolation and loneliness. Mm-hmm. And I also feel like, with him, like with the slow burn he builds, I think one of the great strengths of this film is that, and him as a director, is that he never spells it out to the audience. You have to be aware and you have to be attentive of what he's doing. And you may not have to completely figure out where he's going with it, but you know that then you can see how the pieces fit together. And they actually, you know, click together so almost effortlessly.
And I think one of the great strengths about the film is that even though it is an incredibly finely calibrated piece, none of the characters feel mechanistic. There is this, like we were talking about, this sense of a divergence, a panoply of histories, personal histories, preceding the film and extending beyond the film.
Well, I guess I wanted to say, since I feel like we're coming near the end talking about this film, I wanted to wrap up by asking you the question, because I think it's pretty evident that we both really love this film. But yeah. My question is, who? It's not whether you would recommend this movie or not. It's who would you recommend this movie to?
Everyone. I mean, I here's the thing. Like, I don't really believe that. You know, I've never been one to believe that any film is. I mean, of course, there are certain films that you wouldn't show to somebody who is not. Who might not have particular inclinations towards that. So, for example, if someone's not a fan of avant-garde cinema, I wouldn't say, hey, you should watch some Andy Warhol movies, you know. But, I mean, the thing about A Brighter Summer Day is that even though it is daunting in terms of its scope, like we were talking about at the beginning of this program, that the Justice League movie came out. And even before this whole Justice League four-hour extended cut with seven chapters and an epilogue, to try and partition it off into these little parts to make it more digestible for a mass audience. Even before that, there is binge watching. So people can binge watch the pretty much 4 hours of content in a single day if they choose to do so with Netflix or Hulu or whatever streaming service they want. And I think the thing about A Brighter Summer Day is that, like Yi Yi, like Edward Yang's films, it requires patience. But I think it's an incredibly rewarding film because what it does is that it provides this sense of, for a film that's very much about obfuscation and about misunderstanding and miscommunication, it provides, I think, an incredible degree of clarity and insight into the psychology of how needless violence, particularly from young people, you know, it's not that it's just in a broad scope of trying to say that, oh, you know, society is what shapes these kids, you know, but it's about when you live in a particular society which it demands a particular degree of perfection or conformity, what does that do to the kids? What does that do to young people who are growing into that? What does that do to a sense of the familial structure, you know, how that disintegrates as well? You see all of the pieces into place, the falling into place in this film. And so what, for me, the reason why I really... why I think A Brighter Summer Day impressed me so much the first time I saw it, and why it just continues to impress me as one of my favorite films, is because it's one of the most richly realized, holistic films ever made about anything. You know, people say a lot about, like, you talk about a film that's sort of like a vision of the world in 2 hours or 3 hours. And for me, you know, at the risk of hyperbolizing, this feels like Edward Yang has placed his camera within a universe for 4 hours, and he's given us the privilege to spend time with these characters and to see them grow and to see some of them perish and to see some of them hopefully survive and to see some of them not survive. And even though some of his characters, there's no one who's pure good or pure bad, everyone is, of course, always within this sort of morally gray area, but there's a tremendous degree of care and attention and compassion to the emotions that everyone is facing in this film. And I think that makes it a deeply moving film.
I completely agree with everything you said. Well, I just want to add too what I love about this movie is that it's not just the fact that it all feels so fully realized with its characters and its mood and ambiance. But also, you know, I was thinking too about how I was alluding to when we were talking about Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, how it sort of formed because from Ang Lee's experience of hearing stories about China and from the films he was watching when he was a kid, how that kind of formed this sort of fantastical perspective of China that then he brought out through Crouching Tiger. For me, A Brighter Summer Day is almost like Yang kind of tapping into, because he's taking a real-life incident, but he's also mixing it with his own personal experiences, his childhood, his upbringing, and his surroundings. And he's trying to, like, capture the sort of impressionistic snapshot in time for himself and wanting to share that. So it's almost like it's like something that's permanently, even though the film was hard to see for so long, it's permanent, this the snapshot of history that he conveys, and that's something that that the Kuomintang or any oppressive government, I feel, could never take away from him. And to make something that was so, you can feel it so personal to him, I think it evokes an emotional response from the audience, and I think it's very much a requirement to see. It's a must-see picture.
Yeah, I mean, in the true sense of the word, it is a must-see. And I love what, I mean, the filmmaker Olivier Assayas was saying about Edward Yang when he passed away. I think it just completely gets to the heart of why I love this film. When he said that Edward Yang chose to become a lucid observer, alternately scathing and tender, of the collapse of the society in which he grew up and of its reformulation as a new world, with a new urbanism, a new architecture, and a new circulation of capital imposed on it. Edward's solitude was above all founded on a utopia, on the faith, one should rather say, that there was another path that would enable him to preserve intact the slender thread that connected his cinema to his country's society when he saw them dramatically diverging.
I think that's a great way to set to conclude this review.
And I think that there's so much that we could just say about this film, but I mean, yeah, I mean, if you haven't seen it, watch the film, read up even more on it, you know, with people like Tony Raines and other scholars, and then watch it again. And
that's one of the beauties of it. There's so much you can uncover and analyze and discover.
Yeah.
But I wanted to transition now to talk about our recommendations for the episode.
Yeah, I guess we should talk about movies that aren't 4 hours long.
Well, I mean, have you seen a film that isn't 4 hours long, or Justice League?
No, my recommendation of the week is not Zack Snyder's Justice League. I'm sad to say.
Is it Joss Whedon's Justice League?
Nope. why do you put me in between a rock and a hard place, Alex? You're just shrugging over there. You're just like, all right, man, don't shoot the messenger. But no, I was thinking a lot about, you know, what I would kind of try to recommend for the weekend. I mean, I was thinking a lot about certain films that I'd seen over the last week and over the last couple of weeks. And I was thinking, because it's also International Women's Month, we had International Women's Day, but I mean, it's also the whole month, and I mean, we should be talking about women filmmakers, regardless of any day of the year. And actually, I just saw for the first time the other day a film by a filmmaker whose work I haven't seen a great deal of, but everything that I have seen, I really admire. And I think she is a truly great filmmaker, and that's An Hui. And it's her 1982 film, Boat People. Which has garnered something of a reputation as one of the greatest or most well-revered, one of the most revered Chinese language films ever made. I think that it's, you know, it certainly has or contains a lot of the longstanding concern of Hui cinema with the plight of refugees as well as the socially disenfranchised within late 20th century East Asian geopolitics. And so, as I was saying, like, it's the third entry in her Vietnam trilogy that she was making in the late 70s and early 80s, and it follows a Japanese photojournalist whose name is Shiomi Akutagawa. He's played by George Lamb, and he returns to Vietnam 5 years after the fall of Saigon to find the nation under seemingly more stable conditions than it was at the end of the American War. But these bucolic images of the new economic zone that he's granted a tour of by the government officials they only obscure what are in fact the harsh living conditions of most of the Vietnamese, which really comes to light when he meets three impoverished children. And he strikes a kinship with these children, particularly with the eldest, who's a 14-year-old girl named Cam Nuong. And Akutagawa only just becomes more determined to procure a safe passage for these children out of Vietnam, the more that he uncovers what is the casual and cold brutality of the ruling government. And, you know, from kind of just this basic summary, I mean, I think, you know, I wouldn't blame you for thinking that this film sounds like something of a three-hanky tearjerker. That would be prime material for Oscar season. In fact, you know, very easily, you know, could have made the list of something that would be nominated for the Oscars come last Monday morning. But while the film is not without its sentimentality, I think Hui is a far more intelligent filmmaker than one who could just fall into that trap entirely. And I think, for one reason, her keen sense of visual composition intersects really nicely with the film's core thematic exploration of this relationship between a chronicler of history and the subjects living that very history in real time. There's this immediacy here, which isn't negated by the placement of the actors in these carefully, though not fussily, positioned postures within the mise-en-scene. And I think there's one character in particular. He's a French-educated military official named Nguyen. He's played by Xi Mengqi. And he's perhaps the most haunting figure in the cast, that's full of haunted faces, and his scarred body bears the remnants of torture that he faced under the Gondindim regime before the war. And it's this ornamentation that he displays to Akutagawa in a key moment in the film. These scars are historical markers of trauma, but Hui is less interested in the scars themselves as she is in the people who bear those scars, to whom they show those scars, and why they show them. Now, that fundamental curiosity is constant with her humanist sensibilities, and that's those sensibilities which earned her plenty of ire from a lot of leftist figures, particularly in France when the film had a secret screening at the Cannes Film Festival in 1982. They criticized the film as having a one-sided portrayal of life under the Vietnamese Socialist Republic, and those criticisms aren't without some validity, but I'd say that Hui's political convictions have never really aligned with towing any kind of party line. If anything, her cinema is one that dispels rhetorical dogma in favor of observing with almost placid lucidity the ordinariness of human dignity, which in itself is, of course, anything but ordinary. Of her features that I've seen, I have to confess, though, Alex, that in spite of its reputation, Bone People isn't my favorite. The narrative structure, it lacks some of the sharp discipline of some of her later, more deceptively simple masterworks. And I'm thinking in particular of a subplot involving the travails of a man who's played by Hong Kong superstar Andy Lau, struggling to escape an NEZ, particularly in the film's second half. And this subplot does feature some legitimately gripping sequences where he has to defuse these landmines that are left behind in the jungle from the war. And I mean, I'd say that they're as suspenseful as anything this side of the climax of Paul and Pressburger's The Small Back Room or Catherine Bigelow's The Hurt Locker, though certainly Hui is less bombastic or less fantastical in terms of her set pieces than Catherine Bigelow is. I think that Lau's subplot, even though it's gripping, it does feel like their passage is drawn from another movie. And they never quite meld with the Akutagawa story in a wholly satisfactory way. And I think it's a little wonder that these scenes were initially developed for a separate movie before Hui and her screenwriter Dai Yong Ping decided to just incorporate them into the film that you see today. But no matter. I think despite some structural missteps, Boat People is still this an affecting, compelling work from one of Hong Kong's greatest filmmakers. And it's a film which finds the artist ruminating on their role in not merely cataloging history, but engaging in a dialectic with the subject who has everything to lose with the click of a camera. I'd say go check it out. It's on the Criterion Channel right now, and it's in a new restoration which looks really quite gorgeous.
Well, I must confess, you've seen more Anh Hui films than I have. She's a director I need to have yet to see her work. But, you know, it's still great. Like, even if it's something that's not her greatest achievement, it's still like, you know, I love the markings of a great director who can still have such striking and powerful material or sequences or performances still. So, yeah, I'll definitely give that a watch.
Please do. I mean, I'd be curious to hear what you think. And I would say, and definitely if you like what you see, go check out some of her later stuff. I mean, some of the stuff is hard to find, but it's all worth tracking down. I mean, did you see any, I mean, just thinking about great directors, what's a great film that you've seen recently?
Well, actually, you know, it's kind of funny because this is a great film that you and I sat down and watched together with a family member the other night. And, you know, I was debating whether or not to include this one because, you know, it's kind of popular, but it's not from Taiwan or an Asian director. It's, you know, kind of more notable to people. But I decided to go with it because what I felt it had in common with A Brighter Summer Day is that it's not just a period piece, but it's one that kind of looks back at the past with more than its fair share of melancholy, you know, especially as it's a climate that's heading towards a more militaristic and oppressive one. And that is Wes Anderson's 2014 masterpiece, The Grand Budapest Hotel. And I don't know how many of you saw this film when it first came out, but I'll just say the story briefly then for those of you who haven't. Essentially, it focuses on a highly renowned European hotel concierge named Monsieur Gustave H., played by the great Ralph Fiennes, who is well respected by the clientele, particularly elderly female blondes. And one day, one of his most regular clients has been mysteriously murdered, just falls dead. And it's not too long after that he is accused of murdering the old woman. And so he ends up having to go on the run with his loyal lobby boy, named who just goes by the nickname Zero. It's not what one would necessarily describe as an ensemble piece, like A Brighter Summer Day, or even if we were looking at some of Wes Anderson's other works, like The Royal Tenenbaums, for instance. It's one where you could say, like, it's the main. It mainly focuses on Gustav H. and Zero, and also, to a certain extent, Zero's love interest, Agatha, played by Saoirse Ronan. But still, it is full of these rich and highly memorable characters that you just remember. And when I saw it when it first came out in 2014, I loved the film instantly for, you know, from its colorful Kubrickian mise-en-scène to its goofy humor. But what stuck out to me watching it again in 2021 was the kind of ominous undercurrent of fascism that is rising in this this fictitious European country that we witness, especially through major characters like the antagonist Dimitri, who is the late widow's eldest son, played by Adrian Brody. And he's a kind of like, he's a ruthless thug. He swears like a sailor. And there's even a scene that really kind of made me think of recent figures I've noticed recently, where when Jeff Goldblum, the executor of the late widow's estate, notices a discrepancy in the will and wants to do a further investigation to it, he just simply tells him, don't make big waves and just wrap this up, to which he refuses because that would be against the law. And that was inescapable to me, especially as in the years since the film first came out, we have seen a rise in the nationalist thinking through various countries all over the world. And so I think that kind of, it's a very bittersweet kind of film where in the way it talks about the struggle to maintain decency and goodness in the face of cruel barbarity, as Gustav H. himself points out. And so that kind of, that sense of humor mixed with the bittersweet melancholy and sadness is very reminiscent of Ernst Lubitsch. But like Lubitsch, Anderson masterfully handles tone without ever becoming too schmaltzy or too cornball. And I think that with all these components, with that and with the mise-en-scene, with the casting and the production design and the music and just everything, I think it still stands as one of, if not arguably, Wes Anderson's crowning achievement.
All right, so two things that I wanted to say, because, I mean, we could have a whole episode about The Grand Budapest Hotel, because, as you were saying, I love this film as well, and it's a film that watched again a few weeks ago. It was a real treat just revisiting it after not watching it since the theater. In spite of, as you've so aptly pointed out, a lot of its very ominous and dark and tragic undercurrents, which I think just make it all the greater. But I think that there are a couple of things, you know, in relation to the Edward Yang movie. I think what's so interesting is that you've pinpointed them both as movies that are looking back. But the Edward Yang movie, A Brighter Summer Day, it's one of the rare movies that's set within its own creator's youth that has absolutely no nostalgia for that age whatsoever. There's a certain a recognition of the fondness of the pop culture paraphernalia, which it sort of became these, as we were kind of noting, these sort of instruments of resistance, but there's also a canny acknowledgement of their shortcomings as well. And the film has no affection for 1960s Taiwan, really. And what the Grand Budapest Hotel is doing, it's a nostalgic for a Europe that never existed, for a time that doesn't really quite exist. And yet the film is not counterfeit in any sense. It is about, on a very fundamental level, the necessity of collective storytelling as a political act, as an artistic act, and as a way of as you say, like kind of maintaining decency in the world. And the thing that also just really struck me this time watching it is the character of Gustav H., that he's a deeply flawed character in a lot of respects.
Oh, yeah. And Fine really brings out, the best as well as his shortcomings.
Well, and what's great, too, is there's this wonderful scene where he loses his temper with Zero. And some of you have seen the film will know that scene where it's after a prison break. And he chastises him. And he says some pretty harsh things about about this young man and saying that, why did you ever come to this country when we could have gotten along very well without you? And what Anderson does isn't the trap of making this person of color make this white person not racist. What he does is, I think, actually something that's a little more complex. And what he does is he presents a person who is completely beheld to the cultural attitudes of their time, including like his own casual sense, his own kind of his own discriminatory ideas that he sort of ingested from the time period. But what Anderson is doing is saying that even within that, all human beings have the capacity to make a conscious decision to empathize with another human being. And in that act of empathizing, you can actually do something that's meaningful with your life. And the film is a story about fundamentally how acts of empathy echo through the ages. And it's about something too that we've been talking about through this episode, which is that life takes away, but art preserves.
Exactly. And, you know, and also in a way that when there's always somebody, what I think these two have in common is that as long as there's some way that for these stories to be told time and time again, then they will never be truly lost.
No. And then it allows us to also continue to sort of expand a sense of imagination as well. You know, and if there's one thing that fascism can't thrive on, it's imagination. So I think that's great, Alex. I think you know, it's been a really great episode. I do feel like, you know, we've only even just begun to scratch the surface with the film Like a Brighter Summer Day. I'm really keen to hear what people think of it when you do see it, or if you have seen it, to share some of your thoughts about the film, about things that we haven't tackled, because I know there's a lot we could talk about.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you have a favorite Edward Yang film, if you have, like, a favorite An Hui film or Wes Anderson film, maybe if there's another, if there's a new Taiwan cinema film that we might not have mentioned that you would like to raise attention to in the comments, please do.
I know, because there's so many of the new Taiwan films, you know, that aren't by Edward Yang or Hao Xiaoshen that are difficult to find. And even Edward Yang was, some of his films were really, as we've been noting, were difficult to watch for so many years. But, I mean, it's a process that slowly is being remedied, and thank goodness for that. But, and thank you, Alex, for sitting down and chatting with me about one of my favorite movies. And
it's my pleasure, and thank you for helping make it possible to, and being so adamant on having this be our subject. I really feel this was a truly enriching and rewarding experience watching this movie.
And I hope that you at home listening, or I mean, you don't have to be at home. You could be wherever. You could be on the subway. Hopefully, you know, social distancing and staying safe. Listening to the episode, I hope you've gotten something out of it. And until the next time, until the next episode of That's the Thing and Smells Like Twin Critics, be well, stay safe, and as always, continue watching great movies.
And remember, we're all in this together.
Is your heart filled with pain? Shall I come back again? Tell me, dear, are you lonesome tonight?